I'm Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. I've been a cop for 27 years. I like to say I got a backstage pass to life. Well, guess what? I got some tickets for you. So come on in, pull up a chair, turn up that volume, and let's go. Chasing Justice is on. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Chasing Justice here on the America Out Loud Radio Network. I'm your host, Lieutenant Joe Pangaro, and it's a fantastic day for us to get together. Today, 3 o'clock, and every weekday at 3 p.m. Make sure you join us right here on Chasing Justice. Now, I've gotten a lot of emails. People want to know, hey, what's going on? Where are we going to hear from those fellas in the neighborhood? Well, they'll be coming back pretty soon, so you tune in each and every week, and we'll have some of the fellas here, maybe some of the ladies, too, back in the neighborhood. So, I'm making my notes, and I'm trying to figure out what can we talk about that, you know, it just isn't overwhelming to us on a daily basis, what's going on with the president, what's going on with politics, what's going on in our country. So I think recently, you know, I talked about the season, seasons. It's amazing how as people, whether here in our country, in the United States or in other countries, seasons and holidays and things are so important to us because they bring us together as a people. You know, we remember, you know, great battles, or we remember, you know, wonderful holidays, or we remember God in some way. And those holidays really are fantastic, those Memorial Days and holidays and all that. And recently we saw one here in America, another seasonal type of thing, is we have the Police Unity Tour. You have all these law enforcement officers from all over the country. Basically, they raise money and then they ride bikes to Washington, D.C., in honor of the fallen officers. Now, we've lost a lot of officers already this year, officers that die in the line of duty. This is near and dear to my heart. As you know, I spent 27 years in law enforcement. It was the greatest career I could have ever had. I really loved the work. I loved the people that I met. I loved the men and women I got to work with. Really tremendous opportunities to see not only the best in people, but to experience things that you really never could. You know, in the beginning of the show, my opening, I talk about, you know, a backstage pass to life. Well, that was actually something that I had coined in an article. Because you realize, as law enforcement, you get to see behind the curtain. You know, we go behind the curtain all the time and we see what's going on in people's lives. We see what's happening with them. We do a search warrant. You get to go search somebody's house. You go through all their stuff. And it's amazing what goes on. So you really do get a behind-the-scenes view of life. I'll never forget doing an investigation with some big high-end person. You know, somebody's got 25 times more money than you and I. And, of course, they commit some kind of crime. And I investigate. And I get a search warrant. And I go to their house. And I'm going through their multi-million dollar house that, you know, you and I will never see. I'm sorry, though, for any of my very, very wealthy listeners. But you get to go and see that everybody's really the same. You know, the difference between my house and one of those big giant houses is they got a 60-inch TV on their bedroom wall, and I got a 36-inch TV on the bedroom wall. We all put our pants on the same way. We're all just people. We just have different circumstance. And that's really where I'm going here. So it doesn't matter what job you have, how much money you have. It doesn't matter your race, your religion. We're all really the same. We are all human beings trying to get through life. So when we look at law enforcement, and I see we have this great celebration, the Unity Tour and remembering the fallen officers, that's really awesome. And then I saw the president did the right thing, President Trump. He lit the White House up blue. That really felt good to me, to see my brother and sister officers treated in such a way by the president. Because I know previous President Obama refused to do it. He didn't do it. He called the police work, you know, they were dumb, they were stupid. There's such a belief out there that violence by police officers is such a common and routine type of thing. That I have to, I'm going to make a connection here between a funny meme I saw, you know, pro-gun kind of a meme, and law enforcement. I saw somebody had this meme out there, and it said there are 300 million Americans, 200 million guns, and a trillion rounds of ammunition. If gun owners were a problem, you'd know it by now, which I think that's kind of self-evident, right? Well, the same thing with law enforcement. Police officers do not go to work every day with an idea of who they can hurt and who they can kill and what damage they can cause to their community that they're sworn to protect. That is not how it works. But that is how a lot of people seem to think that it does work. And the president lighting up the White House blue, I thought was fantastic. It's a great seasonal type of a thing to remember the officers riding down to the memorial and the president lighting up the White House to say thank you. Law enforcement is important. We appreciate the sacrifices because there are a lot of sacrifices that our cops make. Number one, the ultimate sacrifice. They sacrifice their lives. How many officers have we lost already? How many did we lose in 2018? How many will we lose the rest of this year? You know, that's something that, all of us people that are living here, none of us really know how long we have. You can be healthy one day, get hit by a bus the next. You don't expect that to happen. You can be healthy one day and then get a horrible piece of news that you have some kind of health issue. And some people are gone almost immediately. In a couple of weeks, they find out and then they're gone. We look at some of our kids in college. They get this, I can't think of the name of it right now, I'm sorry. It's a virus that affects their brain. And they're gone in 3 days. You know, it doesn't happen a lot, but it does. Right here by me, here in New Jersey, there was a beautiful young lady, 17 years old, her and her friends, the day after graduation, and they're driving around, and the car leaves the road, and this poor young lady loses her life. So you never know. We never know. The thing with law enforcement is, you go to work every day knowing today might be your day. Because you're in a business where people try to kill you, where they shoot at you, where they stab you, right, where these things happen. Now, I'm sure that can happen to a plumber. I know a lot of plumbers. I know they've had a lot of horrific things happen to them on the job. I watched Mo, Larry, and Curly try and do a plumbing job, and it was horrible. But it's not the same as law enforcement. When the men and women of law enforcement go to work and they kiss their family goodbye, that could be the last time they see them because that's the nature of the job. But they don't hold back. They go forward. And they do their job. They do it bravely and they do it wonderfully. And I'm very, very proud of all my brothers and sisters who are out there still serving today. So in New York, a couple of years ago, a man named Eric Gardner was standing in front of some stores in New York and he was selling Lucy's, you know, individual cigarettes. Now, this is something that I guess a lot of people in law enforcement have heard of. A lot of regular people who were not police officers never heard of this, but you know, you figure a pack of cigarettes is, you know, what, 15 bucks, 10, 15 bucks? I'm not a smoker, so I'm taking a guess. I know it's high. And there's 20 cigarettes in a pack. Well, if you buy a pack for 10 and you sell them a dollar a piece, you make a couple of dollars. Now, for everyone who has a regular job and goes out and does a regular job, you might say, you're going to do all of that? You're going to stand on a corner and sell cigarettes to make $6? To some people, that is how they support themselves. Now, I'm not saying it's right. I'm saying that's what they do, you know. So apparently this Mr. Gardner was a known person that would sell Lucy's in front of the businesses. At the time, the businesses were all complaining that they didn't want people out front selling Lucy's. He wasn't the only one to do it. But they were trying to, you know, have their businesses be run like businesses and not have people on the streets accosting people or whatever. And the city had decided that they were going to crack down on these kind of crimes. So they sent teams out to go find these kind of people. Well, the police go and they see Mr. Gardner, and he is selling cigarettes, and they go to arrest him. And this is where the story diverges, and this is where it gets kind of crazy. Because Mr. Gardner ended up deceased shortly after this encounter began. He didn't get shot. He wasn't beaten to death. What happened was he resisted arrest. All right, he resisted arrest, and the officers, and he was a big man. You know, I think he was well over 250 pounds. He's a big guy, tall, and he just would not comply. You know, when a police officer says you're under arrest, doesn't matter whether you agree or not. You submit to the arrest. That's what our society has said. That's what our society has demanded. You don't get to argue with the officer out on the street. He says you're under arrest, or she says you're under arrest. You're under arrest. You submit. You turn around, put your hands behind your back, and you submit to arrest. You make bail, you get out, you get a lawyer, you fight it in court. You don't get to resist or argue your case or whatever. You just don't. A civil society does not work that way when people are arguing constantly about things like this. The police have a job to do. So the officer shows up, tries to take him into custody. He resists arrest. Now they're trying to take control of this very large man, and they're wrestling around with him. And at some point, the officer gets him on the ground, and it appeared he put him in a chokehold. Now, a chokehold is specifically to wrap your arm around someone's neck and choke them out. Okay, what happens? You cut off the air to these people, and what happens is people will pass out, and this way they're not fighting you anymore. Well, our society, as our society evolves, we have seen that sometimes people don't recover from a chokehold. They die. So they have said that in many communities, police departments across the country, the chokehold is not authorized. You're not allowed to use a chokehold because people could end up dead. In the case of Mr. Garner, as he's laying on the ground and the officer's got his arm around, looks like around his neck, but the man is saying, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. Well, the reality is if somebody's choking you out, not only can't you breathe, you can't talk. So when I watched that, I said, gee, I know New York's going to have a problem with this because just the way it looks, what everybody is saying happened. But apparently the autopsy showed that the man died from an asthma condition, probably brought on from being such a big, large guy and involving himself in such a physical altercation. Taken to the ground. I guess his asthma kicked in. I don't know. I'm not a medical examiner and I didn't read the full report. But I know he didn't die from a chokehold. But it looks like he's in a chokehold when you see the picture, when you see the video. Except I didn't see the guy's arm around his neck choking him out and he could talk. I don't want to relitigate the entire case, but I know the officer right now is in the middle of an internal affairs trial to determine if he did the right thing, if he violated policy, and he may lose his job. But the fact is, it brings up a question. When I saw that, you know, many police departments have decided that the chokehold is not a valid tool to use. You can't use chokehold. You can use an arm lock. You can use PR-24. You know, you can use all these other tools, but you can't do it chokehold. So I have to ask myself, if you're in a fight as an officer, if you're in a fight for what you think is your life, and you think they're going to be able to seriously injure you, a third person, or kill you, you are allowed to use deadly force to protect yourself. You're allowed to shoot someone if you think they're going to kill you. Wouldn't a chokehold be the same kind of thing? I mean, if I think this guy's really going to hurt me or he could kill me, and I use the chokehold, and I'm using deadly force, if I'm authorized to use deadly force, isn't that the same thing? I am not advocating for chokeholds. I am not saying anything specifically about the Garner case. It just posed a question. I'm saying the officer is allowed to use, if somebody is shooting at you and you're in your police car, you can run them over. And we've seen that on videos, right? Somebody's firing a gun, they see the cop, they're shooting at the cop runs them over with the car. The weapon you're allowed to use is whatever you need to protect yourself. You know, so if a chokehold is something that would have protected the officer, I see where it's a bad thing. But how much are we supposed to let our officers be injured, beaten, or killed before they're allowed to do whatever they need to do to fight back? I don't know. It's just a question. All right? So please don't email me and tell me, you know, I'm in favor of chokeholds and I want to kill people. That's not what I'm talking about. Here on Chasing Justice, we bring up concepts and we think about things. So that's what I'm trying to bring up. All right, that brings up the use of force. I saw an article, and I'm going to see if I can find this article, because I told you a couple weeks ago I want to find a newspaper and talk about it. And basically, I don't have the article in front of me, but it was an ACLU website. And it was underneath the question of some California towns are trying to restrict the law enforcement officers' ability to use deadly force. They want to make rules that say you can only use deadly force in these two conditions. So if an officer, they want to take out of it the officer's perception that they are in physical harm, where they could be seriously injured or killed, where they then use deadly force. Now, those instances where officers use deadly force are really very limited, because just like the gun guy analogy I was making, if cops wanted to go out and kill people every day, there would be hundreds of thousands of people who got killed. And that's not how it works. You know, I know some officers who have used deadly force in the line of duty, and it's something that stays with them forever and ever and ever. They don't go out there to manhandle people, to kill people, to hurt people. They go out to do their job, and sometimes they're put in a position where they feel like, hey, they might get killed, or their partner might get killed, or a citizen might get killed, and they use deadly force. And it's something they have to live with forever. Now, as the caveat to that, I will say that that doesn't mean, oh, well, we should just let the cops do whatever they need, they feel they need to do. Our officers need to be absolutely trained, the best possible training they can get, so that they understand how they can help themselves. So this article in the ACLU website was talking about police use of deadly force. And the wording that the person who wrote the article was using was that there's too many police officers and police brutality and police violence going wild across the country, killing innocent people when the officers could do other things other than use deadly force. It was horribly written. It was, first of all, it immediately told me the point of view of the writer. There was no guessing. This person was obviously to the left of things and doesn't see the need for the police to be out there doing their job. And unfortunately, that's what a lot of that organization has turned into. Anti-law enforcement, anti-rule of law, all that kind of thing. But the whole idea of this police week, the blue White House, all of these things, we have to remember, these cops, these men and women, they go out every single day to protect us, to keep us safe. And sometimes they get put in very, very bad positions where they have to make a split-second decision. Now, these are not rogue people. The law enforcement in your community, in my community, are not rogue. They don't decide to just get together, get some guns, go out and do some things. Law enforcement officers are appointed through the power of the state to go out and enforce the laws that you and me, the citizens, have demanded of our legislatures. We want protections from robberies and rapes and murders and assaults. And therefore, we come up with these laws. The legislature puts them out there, and then someone has to enforce them. Those are the men and women of law enforcement. And they go out and do that. Sometimes bad things happen. Absolutely. Sometimes officers make a mistake. Sometimes they overreact. No doubt. We're human beings. Cops are human beings. Mistakes get made. And it is horrible tragedy when it ends up in a death of an innocent person. I wouldn't want somebody in my family to be killed by a police officer who made a bad decision. I would feel horrible about it, and I'd be screaming and hollering if it happened, no doubt about it. But the reality is, most of those confrontations where people end up hurt, injured, or killed when they are in a confrontation with the police takes place because the person did not listen to the officer. The person resisted. The person pulled away. The person fought. The person had a weapon, or the person decided to try and take off, and it ended up in a chase, which now everything is confusing. Somebody stops, makes a quick turn. You don't know that they have a weapon or not. Are we expecting our officers to die because someone chose not to follow the law and we insist that they enforce the law? I think we need to think about this as we go forward as a people. We have to protect our police from improper prosecutions, but we also have to train them so that there are no accidents. So ladies and gentlemen, that's where we're going to start. We'll be right back with round two of Chasing Justice here on the America Out Loud Radio Network.
The Out Loud perspective awaits you in life, love, politics, a healthy lifestyle, your faith, personal development, and living an out loud life on AmericaOutLoud.com. Blitz your news and entertainment network where you can listen 24/7 on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Hello, my beloved audience. And yes, I borrow that from Mark Levin because I like Mark Levin and he says that. And you are my beloved audience. Welcome back to Chasing Justice here on the America Out Loud Radio Network. I want to tell you, if you get a chance to listen to the newest program on the platform, is The Voice of a Nation, is excellent. It's on Thursday nights at 6 o'clock with Malcolm Out Loud as the host. Always excellent. I was honored that he had me on. It's really a fantastic program. you ought to go take a listen. Listen to also Lieutenant Randy. Right? Lieutenant Randy is a tremendous voice for law enforcement. And since we're talking a little bit about law enforcement people today, go listen to Lieutenant Randy and everybody else on the platform. So I was sitting back trying to figure out what's really important to me and what I want to talk about, what I want to use this valuable airway time for. And the first thing I thought of was Marisa Joy, my daughter.
Hello.
Hello, everybody. Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
So Marisa's been on with us a couple times before. And what I really appreciate about my daughter is that she is a thinker. She's a person who puts some time into things that are important to her. She researches it. She goes to try and figure it out. Her and I have sometimes different points of view on things. And I think that's great. Because unlike people who can't have a conversation, Marisa and I, we will get annoyed with each other. Okay, we will trigger each other once in a while in conversations. But we always seem to find a way to get back. All right, let's talk about facts. Let's talk about what's really going on here. Let's try and educate each other and see if we can learn something from each other. And isn't that what a conversation is really supposed to be?
Right. I agree.
That's excellent. I'm also a good listener, so that's good.
Yes.
So one of the things that Marisa brought up to me was the problem we're seeing in society of teen suicide. Now, we don't always get a lot of conversation about this, but the numbers of suicides have gone up exponentially. I know recently I was talking about kids in school who were bullied, and we're starting to see kids as young as 8 years old or 9 years old that are being bullied and killing themselves. You never saw that before, you know? So, Marisa, I know you have a lot of information here. Why don't you say hi? Let's tell us a little bit about you first. You going to school? What are you doing?
Hi, yeah. I'm going to Pace University in the fall for my sophomore year of high school, and I'm going for a degree in film and acting, which is really exciting.
Your sophomore year of high school?
Oh my gosh, college, sorry. College, I should be in college.
Yes.
So I actually went to LIU for a year and I took a really interesting psychology class because I was so interested in learning about why people do what they do. So that's where I'm getting a lot of these statistics and numbers about the problem that we're experiencing with children with mood disorders and self-harm. Mm-hmm. And I really care about learning about that to kind of see what we can do in the future to help the kids who are growing up.
So before we get into your statistics, you know, why is it, you know, you're a young woman out there in the world, you're pursuing an acting career and you're pursuing a college career. Why do you care about this? What does it, are you suicidal?
I am not suicidal. However, growing up, I have had lots of girlfriends, especially who have struggled with mood disorders and with self-harm. And now that I've graduated high school and I'm in college, I already know a few kids from my high school and from my town who have taken their own lives. And it's very shocking to me to know that there's so many people who are struggling, and I really wanted to try to figure out why.
I think that's excellent.
Mm-hmm.
And I like your idea of, you know, in the future, how to maybe help.
Right.
Because you never know where you're going to end up once you get your college education and you get your career going, what kind of career you're going to end up in. I know you want to be an actress and you're very talented. So any of my friends out there that are producers that are listening, if you want the next It Girl, all right, here she is right here. You say jpangaro@americaoutloud.com. We want Marisa in our next movie, and you will not be sorry.
I will not disappoint.
She's very confident, too. I wonder where she gets that from. So this is important to you because you know people that are hurt. What kind of self-hurting are you talking about?
So one of the most staggering statistics that I'd love to talk about is the rates of self-harm in young girls, and that is mainly cutting and burning themselves. And it's something that a lot of people statistically from older generations aren't really understanding why and how and all of that. So the research that I've done to try to piece it together for myself shows that there's one very specific theory of why it's happening, and it's just in young girls. And I've seen it, and I'm seeing it now, and it just really makes you think there must be something that we can do differently to help these young kids.
So for people who don't know that, they call them cutters, right? They call these kids cutters. And what they do is they secretly use sharp objects, glass, knives,
razors,
all kinds of things, razors, and they cut themselves, and they usually do it where? In places where you can't see it, right?
Yeah, so typically, especially recently as it's gotten more, people are more aware of it, it's usually young girls who are cutting themselves in areas where you're not going to see it. And it's a way to just self-harm. And there's many theories of why they do it. But it's basically taking out your anger, your depression, or your mood on yourself in a way of like self-punishment.
Self-punishment, self-loathing. You don't like yourself.
And a lot of the girls who are doing it, in fact, I want to get into all of these, but the majority of girls who are doing this are 10 to 14-year-old girls.
Really?
Which is preteens. That's insane that these girls are so young. And they're making this conscious decision to come home from school and do that.
Well, I just want to add one caveat. Mm-hmm. This is, and I think you're right, because in law enforcement, I saw a lot of this. Since I've left law enforcement and I was in the schools, I was shocked about how much of this actually goes on.
Right.
And we know, you and I, we knew somebody personally who was involved in mm-hmm. this. And I've had other people say to me since then, you know, what the only thing about this cutting, my daughter is cutting herself. And it's like, we're not psychiatrists here. We're not psychologists. We're not giving you the answer. But if there's anybody in your family, make sure you reach out and get them some help. Somebody who's cutting themselves is not just having a bad day or having a problem. They need to go talk to somebody to get some help. So go ahead, Misa. You got some stuff here for us.
Okay, so I'm very into podcasts. Obviously, I get to be on this one. But one that I watched is one with American psychologist Jonathan Haidt. Mm-hmm. And he focuses on social psychology. And he basically took surveys over a period of about 10 years on the U.S., Britain, and Canada on why people are self-harming and having more mood disorders now than ever.
Mm-hmm.
So he found that mood disorders and behavior remained stable in like the 90s and early 2000s. But with younger girls, Gen Z, as those years went on, the rates got higher. And they all contribute that mostly to the use of social media and having iPhones and cell phones so young.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that for a second, because that makes perfect sense.
So what he describes is, and I'll get to these numbers soon, is that girls tend to have more of the mood disorders and boys tend to have more of the antisocial disorders. So girls would have like more depression and anxiety and things like that. And girls bully in a very specific way. And bullying is such a problem, especially in these preteens. So that really makes sense of mm-hmm. why it's happening more to them. They bully and it's called social bullying. And you don't want to hurt someone's feelings alone, but you want to kind of hurt them socially, ruin their social status.
What is that all about? I know with guys,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I'm only going from my experience.
Right.
Guys get together and, you know, there's somebody that wants to come into your group and maybe you don't like them because they threaten you in some way.
Mm-hmm.
You're the leader or you're the best thrower of the football. And now somebody wants to join your group who wants to be a thrower, who has talent, and you don't want them there.
And it's more one-on-one.
Right, and you get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a group, you just don't like them as a group, but that's it. With the girls, even I saw as you growing up, the
yeah.
things that happened with you were amazing. I couldn't believe it.
And I think one thing that they contribute that to is called in-group, out-group theory. And that's in order to feel like you're in the in-group, girls more have a tendency to try to make other girls feel like they're the out-group and they're the outcasts. So basically, we have all these young girls, and they're in, you know, that kind of self-loathing, awkward stage in middle school, all surrounded with each other. And we give them smartphones and cell phones with social media, Twitter, you know, Facebook, Instagram. And they're little tools for these girls to ruin each other's social lives.
Right.
So
and they say
can,
nasty things to each other.
They can online bully. They can harass each other. And these girls never turn off their phones. So they don't leave school and get a break from the bullying as the boys do. They go home and they're bullied online, and it's much more prevalent for these young girls.
Right, and that's something that in a recent show, I was actually on Malcolm's show, Voice of a Nation,
mm-hmm.
and we were talking about, you know, what's causing, what's part of maybe these shooters, and we talked about how, you know, if you're a bully or you are bullied or you're ostracized, you put those things together, and that could lead to someone who strikes out.
Mm-hmm.
Where boys, we know 96% of school shooters, school violence people, are boys.
Mm-hmm.
Which would match what you're saying these statistics are. Boys strike out
yes.
like that, where girls hurt each other with social media.
For girls, it's called internalized bullying. So you're using much more subtle ways to hurt someone socially.
And what is the purpose of that? Just to give you status in the group?
It's especially in these younger girls because you're kind of learning what a social hierarchy is. And you're in school for the first time with all these young adults.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of just seems natural that you want to have status. So you want to make other people feel like outcasts so you can feel.
That's interesting. So you're saying, what was the ages here? 10?
So yeah, 10 to 14. So I want to show you self-harm in 2009. These are the rates that it had risen, and it took 5 years, and they polled it in 2009. girls from 20 to 24, 17% it went up of who self-harms.
Okay.
15 to 19, 62% it had risen. Mm-hmm. Gen Z girls, it was 189% rise in 2009 of self-harming themselves, which is cutting and burning.
Right. So let's take a minute and try and think. You know, one of the things I talk about is why, you know, in the shooter community, and I'm not relating girls who are having this problem to the shooter community. I'm simply saying it's about going from a child to being a young adult. And I think that transition is very hard, which is why middle school mm-hmm. is historically horrible for yes. lots of people. Because in elementary, you're just a kid. You're a little kid. You're with other little kids. When you get to middle school, now that's when your body starts to change.
Mm-hmm.
You enter puberty, many people, earlier than later, some of them. But then you start to notice boys and girls. You start mm-hmm. to like people. You start to see these cliques start to happen. And that's when you want to be a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
These 10-year-olds, you're talking fifth grade.
Yeah.
That's the elementary. We're seeing it go down.
It's getting younger and younger every single year.
And it's the social media.
So what they say is when everyone started having smartphones in their pockets all the time and all of this social media, it really just eventually started hurting the people who were using it the most, which happened to be preteen girls.
Mm-hmm.
So you go online and you just see everyone has more friends than you, everyone you think is prettier than you, and it makes you loathe yourself. And so seeing constantly posts about either how great everyone else is makes you feel ostracized,
mm-hmm.
or getting online bullied and seeing people tell you how terrible you are makes you dislike yourself.
Sure. Now, how easy is it for a young girl to fall in and out of these groups where one day you're in favor and the next day you're not in favor?
It is so easy. What my personal experience, especially in middle school, is it was you're in the group, and then if you kind of start rising and people like you or something like that, you become more and more liked by people, more people want to make you unlikable, you know? So it's as you get more confident in yourself or happy, it tends to look like these girls and groups want to bring you back down to where you belong, and that's where the bullying happens.
So is it, and what you're describing sounds to me like if we all just stay status quo and
mm-hmm.
nobody tries to rise ahead,
yeah.
then we're all good.
Yeah.
The minute somebody starts to differentiate themselves in a positive way,
yeah.
now that threatens everybody in the group.
Yeah,
and
people,
now we got to get rid of her.
People look at it like it's a threat. So it's terrible because they either want you to feel bad about yourself, that's the norm, or just feel normal. But the second you start doing something that's positive or feeling positive or being more liked, it kind of seems like they want to drag you back down so you're not outshining anyone.
Hmm. That's painful. And I've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen, you know, I remember you coming to me and being all upset one time because you had your phone. And now you weren't 10, but mm-hmm. you were a little older than that. But you had your phone and you were all upset. And I said, what's the matter? And you had a nice group of girlfriends. And all of a sudden they were all mad at you.
Mm-hmm.
And they said terrible things. And you were so upset. And I told you, you know what? Turn the phone off.
Right.
Stop looking at it. And then 3 days later, you were going over to that one of the girls' houses that was the worst problem. And you said, oh, yeah, we worked it out. We're all good now.
And yeah. And one of the biggest things is back in, I think when you were a kid, if you're getting bullied at school, you can go home. At least you have a break from school where you're
mm-hmm.
getting bullied. Nowadays, you can't escape it. It's on your phone. You're getting text messages. It's popping up on your laptop. So they say that having no break from it is mm-hmm. what's really emotionally and mentally hurting these kids.
Well, it would be. If it's negativity and it's constantly pounded at you,
yeah.
that you're wrong, you're bad, you're no good, and there is no respite from it.
There is.
Now, this is funny because when I talked with Malcolm, I saw this point very clearly. And it's funny. You and I didn't pre-discuss this.
Mm-hmm.
I said, it's that social media that you can't get away from. At least back in the day, if you were bullied at school, maybe you had a fist fight, you had to deal with it, they called your names on the bus, you got off the bus, and you had till the next day.
Right.
And you had a break from it. You could go play with your own friends, do your own thing. Then you'd only have to deal with it in school. This social media, you're right, is never ending. This stuff, my phone is never off.
Mm-hmm.
I'm constantly, you know, looking at my social media and emailing and talking to people.
So just imagine if it was a ton of, like, your peers telling you, you're too fat, you're not fun, no one likes to be around you, just constantly. It's going to start making you want to maybe believe it.
Do my friends say that about me? They're not telling
me? Not to me. They don't say
that. Oh, thank goodness. I was going to say, holy moly. But this is very, very serious, Marisa. And I am so proud of you that you would bring this up because we were talking about what topics we could bring up today, because I want something. I love to bring in the young person's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I like to have young people on the show to let us know, everybody who's up at the top of the hill, what's going on down below, because you are going to take over the world.
So basically, I think what a great message to take away from this would be, and what I took away, is we should look at our younger kids and just pay attention to how they're all treating each other, because it's not adults bullying them for the most part, it's they're bullying each other. So if they can have that respite, if they can come home and feel relaxed and safe, mm-hmm. it might help them with that self-harm that's just so prevalent.
So what do you think about an enforced no social media after 2 o'clock in the afternoon or 5 o'clock at night?
So what Jonathan was saying, the social psychologist who was giving these statistics, is that he and a huge group of people, parents from his daughter's school, they're in eighth grade, they signed a petition that about 15 of these parents said, we're going to keep our kids off smartphones until freshman year of high school.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that has been so good for their group because mm-hmm. these kids don't feel like they're the only one without a smartphone.
Right.
But it's letting them mature before they get all of that.
Very smart. Because yeah. that in itself would be something to pick on somebody about, right?
Exactly.
Everybody has a phone but you.
So they say if a couple parents band together, your kid won't feel like the outcast. They'll just be a group of kids who are waiting a little longer.
Right. And here's the message for parents that are out there. I know I have a lot of younger parents listening and you're saying, well, not my kid, not my daughter, not my son. The reality is this. This is the world they live in, not the world we live in. Okay? Even if you're younger than I am, and you're a parent, and you're saying, well, our generation's different, our kids aren't going to have that problem. What you're hearing Marisa telling you from real life experience is that these are your daughters and sons having these problems. This social media is causing this kind of pain and trouble. It's a great thing we have, social media, to connect with people. I've met people I haven't seen in 50 years. It's awesome. And I can connect to people about my business and what's going on, and you hear people's birthdays. That's wonderful. There's an other side to it. This is the painful side. There are kids out there cutting themselves, committing suicide, feeling horrible about themselves. We need to look at this seriously. We need to take this seriously and do what we can. Final word, Marisa.
I would just like to say it's so important to realize that even though social media is amazing, I use it every day, tons of people use it, I would advise for these younger kids, it's so important to at least monitor how much time they spend on it. Because if you're not mature enough to understand, oh, these people don't like me, I'll move on, it's really going to hurt you. And it's going to have a lasting impact on how you see yourself and treat yourself.
That's fantastic. And I want to thank you very much for coming on Chasing Justice.
Thank you.
Isn't that kind of what justice is, right? Making sure everybody has a fair shot, making sure everybody has a good life and move ahead and become the best that they can possibly be. And they can't do that if they're feeling horrible. So parents, take notice. Listen to Marisa. Watch out with that social media. We'll be right back with round three here on Chasing Justice in 1 minute.
I'm going to ask you to go to thewoundedblue.org. That's www.thewoundedblue.org. That is the website for the organization that is the National Association for Injured and Disabled Police Officers. It is a support organization for these men and women who have given so much in the line of duty. We desperately need your help to raise money to get this movement going. And if you are a GoFundMe-er, go to GoFundMe, look up The Wounded Blue, and you can give there as well. But check it out, please, and also check out our film, The Wounded Blue, on Amazon.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Chasing Justice. Ding, 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 here on round three. I got to tell you, I think that was an excellent conversation with Marisa Joy. Not only is she a well-spoken, articulate young woman. She really is very intelligent and her heart is absolutely in the right place. And we do go back and forth a lot of times here in my house with points of view. Marisa is a little more progressive than dear old dad, but we do learn from each other. You know, I've learned a lot from her because she can, in a very appropriate way, explain to me things that maybe I'm not seeing, points of view I'm not seeing. And I've also been able to, believe it or not, be able to make some points to her. So it would be nice on a bigger scale, if the progressives and the conservatives could actually talk to each other. Maybe there'd be room for us to make some headway and solve some of the problems we have in the world. So I want to tell you a couple of minutes about True Security Design. One of the things we're offering now is a student-based threat assessment, employee-based threat assessment. you know, all the stuff we do to help protect our schools from an attack is very important. When for a school comes under attack and our children and staff are in danger, we have to be able to lock down quickly and respond to that violence as it takes place. Wouldn't it be so much better if we could identify potentially dangerous people before they strike out and we could intervene, right? Get them the help they need and save everyone from the grief of being injured and killed and all that other nonsense and terrible things that happen. So that's what True Security Design is now offering, a student-based threat assessment for schools and also a business-based assessment. Because we all have worked with some people who sometimes they've been a little bit off and you say, hey, if anybody ever did anything weird, it would be Bob over there. Well, there's a way to identify that and then intervene so that people don't get hurt. And that's where we need to go with all of this. You know, it's one thing to, you know, always be able to respond as it happens. We're always going to need that because we're not going to know when all of these are coming. But in almost every case of workplace violence or a school shooting, there's lots of people that knew something was up and they didn't take action. So we teach you how to develop a team, what to look for, how to interpret writing, reading, words, social media, all of that, so you can intervene before violence takes place. So do me a favor, go take a look, please, at www.truesecuritydesign.com. Go visit our website, read some of the articles I have on there, look at the programs we have, and we are nationwide. We will come anywhere to provide this training for you, your business, or your school district. All right, truesecuritydesign.com. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. So, our world is an interesting place and a dangerous place. And you say, well, wouldn't it be great if everybody just got along? So we're hearing the president is talking a lot about Iran all of a sudden. Iran comes back up into the conversation. And we have military, naval convoys heading over to the Gulf because there's concerns that Iran's going to do something. Our people have been moved out of Syria, non-essential personnel, because we're afraid the Iranians are going to do something. The reality is the Iranians have been a problem since 1979. Now, I know some Iranian people, and they're lovely individuals. I'm not talking about the individual Iranian people on the ground in Iran. We're talking about the government, the mullahs who are ruling Iran. They are supporting terrorism around the globe. Hamas and other groups are supported by them. They instigate terror attacks all over the place. They are absolutely aiming to at some point get a nuclear weapon. And this is not a thing. Again, how many times can I say this? These things are not a joke. We are watching the buildup in Iran towards a nuclear weapon. And they are the kind of government that would not be afraid to use it. Do you think if they had a nuclear weapon that they would be concerned about tossing it over the border at Israel? That would engulf the entire world in World War III. And it would be devastating beyond our belief at this point because our equipment, our munitions, our bombs, everything we have to destroy and kill people is 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times stronger than it was in World War II. If we allow the Iranians to go ahead. Now, that's a funny thing when I say that. If we allow, right? It kind of sounds like, you know, who the hell are we to say what we allow one group of people to do or another? So I think we need to think about that for a minute, because that's the argument against American intervention in a lot of things, is that, well, who the hell are the Americans to say? You have nuclear bombs, and you've used one. Yes, we did. And we used it, I thought, for the right reason. Now, if we could have found some other way to stop that war, that would have been the thing to do. But unfortunately, at the time, it would have cost 1 million additional American lives. There has to come a moment when the leadership has to make a decision. Has to make a decision on what's right for their people. Now, I'm not saying that the right decision today would be to use a nuclear weapon anywhere, because there's so many of them now, so many countries have them, that it would start a firestorm that we might not be able to recover from. But the reality is, back then in World War II, I have to say, the president did the right thing. He had a choice, lose 1 million more Americans, and remember, we didn't start that conflict. We were simply trying to survive it and put down evil. And he had to make a choice. He had this weapon. We didn't understand the ramifications of what that weapon was at the time. We knew it was extremely powerful. It was the next powerful thing that could maybe stop the war. And he had a choice to use it and stop the war and save millions of people, or not use it and continue to fight. And, you know, what would have happened to the people in Japan had we not used those bombs? They were down to the point of old women, old men, and children with sticks going to rush the beach against American troops. It would have been horrific in so many more ways. It's never good when we have to fight each other and kill each other. But I think, you know, looking at that, that was a moment in time when that was okay. We're looking at now the future. And we're saying we're watching Iran do this. Does anybody doubt that they haven't stopped? Even though they were supposed to have this Iran deal and Obama gave them, what, $150 billion on a pallet with money, cash, gold, all kinds of things? You think they didn't take that money and use that to further this program? We can't go over there and check. But we're kind of sitting back, and it's just like with North Korea. Oh, they gave Bill Clinton all kinds of, assertions that, well, we're not doing it. We won't thank you for the money. Thank you for the food. We're not, and next turn behind us or back. What were they doing? They were still building the bomb, and now they have a nuclear weapon, and they are a danger to the world. The Iranians are the next group. You know, there comes time that the adults in the room have to sit around and figure out, what are we going to do about this? Now, I think it's pretty clear, that if they were to take any kind of direct action against an American ship in the Gulf or anywhere else, or if they were to actually do some kind of Iranian identified attack on Israel, that the response from Israel alone would be devastating to the Iranian government. And they know that. But if they were to attack an American ship, I think at this point we have a president who is not afraid to respond back, and the response would be absolutely devastating to Iran, and unfortunately to a lot of the Iranian people who, never forget, in the background, they are looking to get rid of these mullahs. They want to have more of a westernized kind of a life, kind of like they were under the Shah. There's a lot of people who want to go back to that, even though we see, the rise of Islam really started there, the Iranian Revolution in 1979. But what are we going to do here? This is a slow dance we're having right now, trying to decide what we're going to do. And look at what our own American people are saying. You know, don't upset them. Don't provoke them. This is what I heard the other day. We are provoking something with them. Wouldn't it be better if, instead of always putting our tail between our legs and worrying about how we're scaring people, that, you know, we don't want to make them upset, that if all of us spoke as one voice and we made it crystal clear that the next time they used terrorism against anybody, they would pay the ultimate price, that we would say, our might is going to stop you. Wouldn't that be much better, instead of being scared and sitting back and worrying about them being angry? How about them being afraid of us again? All right? Let them be afraid of us, that if they do the wrong thing, they will suffer the consequences. You know, peace through strength is something that works. We've lost that. We've got this whole thought pattern these days that if we're just nice to everyone, everybody will get along. Well, you know what? Where does that actually work? If you're just nice to everybody, we'll get along. You know, President Trump went over to North Korea and he says, instead of rattling sabers and screaming and holler, let me see if I can make a relationship with this guy. Okay? Let me see if I can make some kind of a relationship and work it out man to man and see if we can get our countries closer together and stop the danger. That seemed to work. But what happens when we hit this impasse? Do you think he's really over there, North Korea, Kim Jong-un, is really going to give up his nuclear weapons? I don't. But maybe we can come to some kind of a deal where we work things out so that it's not so dangerous. But I think he also understands, if you do the wrong thing, the United States will attack you. The Chinese know this. That's why the Chinese stepped in and had to have a little bit of a conversation over there. But what happened recently? We're in an impasse. We have not come to an agreement. And they started launching missiles again. They're sending us a signal. They're not worried about offending us. They're not worried about making us mad. They're showing us. They're waving their sword around, going, hey, we got missiles. We don't need to have a peace plan. We're going to do what we want. If you set up a situation where these rogue governments were so afraid of doing something like that, you would keep them under control, because that's the only way you control evil and you control bad people. They do not speak nice thoughts. They do not speak in terms of, let's be friendly, let's work this out. The only thing they understand is, if they lift their hand's going to get destroyed. And that's what we used to have, you know? who was it? Back in the day, Roosevelt speaks softly and carry a big stick. Right? We don't do that anymore. Now we speak softly, we act even softer, and people think they can walk all over us, and they can. Because unfortunately, I don't know that we have the backbone to do what we need to do anymore. Even just talking about this, I'm sure, is making some people extremely uncomfortable. The idea of America being so powerful is so scary to people that they can't even have a conversation about it. And we see our leaders, up until recently, have all taken that position. And when I see these people jumping up and down screaming about, don't provoke them. To hell with that. Don't provoke us is what everybody should be worried about. Right? Our actions have shown over the years that we are not this evil empire coming after you to attack you and take you over. But we will do the right thing. I just don't know if we can do it anymore. And you think the danger that that poses. Because if you allow evil people to think that they have power, they're going to use it. That's one of the connections of being evil, is that you use the power that you have. Being a good guy means you have power and you hold it back. You only use it for specific things. Evil people use power for all of their means. So I want to talk a little bit about that as we move along here with Iran and see what's going to happen. You know, there was a time when they were, what, running up to our ships with their little gunboats, and we wouldn't even shoot back at them. And then Trump said recently, if you come towards one of our boats, we're going to sink you and destroy you. Right? You notice we haven't had any of those attacks recently. They don't come running up to our boats anymore because they know the big stick is going to smash them. So that's how that really works. Don't kid yourself. Strength is what makes things happen in the rest of the world. Everything else in the world is not America. All right, it's not America where we sit here and argue until we're blue in the face and we come up with all these ridiculous points of view. All right, so I talked in the beginning about Police Week and how we've recently had that, and we're trying to think about our law enforcement community. And the reality is, every week should be Police Week. All right, our cops are out there doing this work every single day. It's an important thing that we have to do. Now, I look at the border control people. These guys and girls are down there trying to protect us from, what do they say? There's going to be 1 million illegal aliens this year coming across the border. How many tons and tons and tons of drugs do they capture at the border crossings? And now they're finding, you know, how many tons you think are getting across that we don't see through the unmarked parts of the thing where there is no fence across the border? And how many American kids does that kill? Well, I saw a statistic the other day. 70,000 American young people a year are dying from drug overdose. 70,000. Right? That could be your kid. Don't kid yourself. The opioid crisis out there is not something for, you know, just those people on that part of town or those people who live over there. The opioid crisis has affected every community. And if it hasn't gotten to yours yet, it's coming. New Jersey here has been devastated by the opioid crisis. In the counties of Ocean County, I think there was 115 deaths last year alone from opioid overdoses. 115 kids in one county. When you combine that with the rest of the counties in the Northeast here where we're having this problem, the Southeast, out in California in that area, 70,000 people. So if it hasn't gotten to you yet, you're very lucky. I was in a community in upstate New York, and I was talking to them, what kind of drug problems you got here? You know, trying to analyze what they're doing. I said, well, we have a lot of vaping, and the kids are smoking a lot of pot, but not really a lot of other drugs. There's some heroin here, but not a lot. And my response to that law enforcement community was, well, put your helmet on, because if you have a little bit of heroin, you're going to have a lot of heroin, and you're going to have people dropping dead left and right. So these drugs are all coming across the border, whether it's at the checkpoints, which they can't check every car, or if they're coming through the holes in the fence, of which there are many. We have to get out there and tighten that up. I saw it was interesting. President Trump has come up with a new immigration policy. It's merit-based immigration. And he said, we want to have people come here that the country needs, you know, merit-based. And Representative Pelosi, of course, comes right out and she says, oh, so what's he trying to say? That families coming here don't have merit? There's no merit to families? Is that really the point that he was making? That there's no merit to families? A hard choice that we have to look at as a people is, it's heartbreaking to see these impoverished young people, men and women with children that have nothing in their homeland, that they don't have enough food, that they do have problems there, they don't have industry, there are no jobs. That is horrible and painful to see. But does that mean that we should open the doors and let everybody in here? Because we have things. Because it's not, gone are the days when you would have a family member emigrate to the country and you had to sign off that you would take care of them. There was no social safety net for people to go on. Now, people come here. They come here uneducated, unskilled. They show up with some of their own children, other people's children, and they are immediately allowed in. And then they go on social welfare, where they're paid as soon as they get here. Well, what better beacon can you put out to the world? Said, hey, guess what? Go to America. Not only will they give you health care and you'll get to vote and you'll get to have a place to live, all paid for by the government, but they're going to give you money too. Who would not want to come along with that deal? I would. I've said this 100 times. If it was me and my family and I saw a place like that, I would probably want to go. The reality is, can we really afford this? How long can we afford this? We have to look around at reality. This is not a game. We have the outbreak of disease that we haven't had in our country in 50 years. We're seeing these diseases attack entire communities now. Things are coming back that were wiped out. Do you want your kids to get these diseases? All right? Is that how nice we should be? That your children should get these diseases that we took care of years and years ago? Should your taxes go up 3 times as much? I don't know. This is another thing we need to talk about as a country. How much benevolence can we really afford? Or do we just give it all away and hope for the best? Well, listen, this has been an interesting episode here of Chasing Justice. I appreciate it. I want to thank Marisa Joy for coming on. And I want to thank all of you out there for listening. So remember, follow us on Twitter at Pangaro Global. Take a look at us on at Chasing Justice on Facebook. And you can reach out to me at jpangaro@americaoutloud.com. Go visit the platform, listen to the shows. And remember, be a part of the solution, not a part of the problem. We'll see you soon.